Today on Rambling About Cars, we have a luxury lineup with news from BMW, Mercedes, Porsche, Cadillac, and we have some great reader comments, some emails to go through, and then we got to talk about barn finds because it seems like they're coming out of the woodwork. Oh, boom, 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 ching. Wah, wah, wow. So let's roll. It's podcast time. I am Christopher Smith, and Mr. Chris Bruce is across the way, and
I sure am. And as always, please like, subscribe, comment, all that fun stuff. And to hype it up, remember March 22nd, Rambling About Cars will be live.
March 22nd.
So make sure you join us. It'll be 7:30 p.m. Eastern. Mm-hmm. What is that? 4:30 p.m. Pacific, I think.
Sounds right.
March 22nd. That's a Wednesday. So.
And remember, and when we say join, we mean that because the platform that we use, if you are with us on Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, you can comment real time during the broadcast. We'll be able to see all of your comments, no matter what platform you're on. It all comes into us, and you then become a guest slash co-host slash rambler active on duty. So we are so super looking forward to that. And I think we're going to have some pretty good guests lined up to join us. It's a big deal. We're going live. You want to be there in March. But right now,
without further ado, let's kick it off with some cars, some car news, some car debut news. So first one we're going to talk about is the 2024 BMW X5 and X6. And if you're a frequent listener, you're like, haven't we already heard about these? And the answer is no, but kind of.
Yes.
BMW debuted the refreshed X5 and X6, the standard models. Earlier in the month, I want to say it was the first week of February. Mm-hmm. And so now they decided towards the end of the month to debut the M models.
Right. And usually there's, I think if memory serves me, there's usually a little bit more of a gap. It seems like they're more interested in getting the high performance models out a little bit sooner. And we have them here. And Bruce, I know you wrote this up.
I did.
The styling has already been discussed previously with the X5, X6.
What's right, the styling? It's basically a new front fascia, and it does get the thinner headlights from the refreshed standard models. The M gets that, but otherwise, there aren't that big styling changes. It's kind of they blacked out some bits, they tweaked the fascias, but nothing too big on the outside.
So that means we have all kinds of big changes under the hood, right?
Well, yes and no. So,
okay. Explain, please. Cause I already know, but let's clue in the ramblers here.
Of course. So it still uses a twin turbo 4.4 liter V8. However, it now gains a 48 volt mild hybrid system. There's an electric motor that's incorporates into the automatic transmission. And that electric motor can make 12 horsepower and 147 pound feet of torque. However, BMW did not change the total output for either the X5 or the X6.
Interesting.
It had 617 horsepower and 553 pound-feet before the refresh, and it still does now, even with that extra mild hybrid assistance and that electric motor.
And BMW, I found it a little, what's the word? Well, I'll just be polite, say a little odd. They mentioned the extra power from that electric motor, but combined, it's not adding anything overall. BMW says it's a little quicker off the line for acceleration, and it'll provide a little bit more fuel efficiency, but 0 to 60 is 3.7 seconds. That's the same as the outgoing model. So where is this extra? I mean, is 0 to 30 like a tenth quicker? Or I mean, it's like BMW.
Sadly, we don't know the answer.
We don't know.
While we're talking engine, it's interesting. While it is the same displacement, it's still a twin turbo. They've added a different exhaust manifold, a reinforced crankshaft, electronically controlled blow-off valves for the turbos, revised air intake, and a tweaked oil pump. So they are actually, those are material like part changes. But yeah, it still makes the same amount of power. So
same power. Same, at least the 0 to 60 performance, still limited to 155 top end. Unless you get the driver's package, then it's back up to 177. I really would like to see, I guess, additional stats from BMW, especially when it comes to efficiency.
Well, what's also interesting is that they said that they lowered the gear ratio for the first three gears of the 8-speed automatic. So generally, you would expect quicker acceleration to come from that, but not in this case.
Yeah, hey, this is the information we got from BMW. It's right. Straight from the automaker. Not suggesting that they're hiding something or anything nefarious like that. It's just in my head, and mind you, I am a writer, not a mathematician. I struggle to add some of this up. Okay, we have a new 48 volt mild hybrid that offers a bit more electric power and a fair amount of additional torque. I mean, that's not an insignificant amount of torque that the electric motor adds, but then all the overall ratings are the same. The gear ratios are tighter in the first three gears. I mean, BMW says it's better off the line. Why aren't we seeing that 0-60?
I don't know.
It's a good question. Ramblers, if you can answer it, podcast@moto1.com. I know all the BMW executives listening. Hey, send us an anonymous email to podcast@moto1.com. You know, create a Gmail account. I don't work for BMW at Gmail. There you go. And clue us in, because I mean, these things are supremely quick. And styling wise, I mean, I dig
60 is quick. Like there's no way you can argue that.
Yeah. So. It's just odd when we hear about mechanical changes like that, and then we don't see, you know, exactly how that's playing out. Now, BMW, they don't mention anything as far as efficiency. So the changes here could raise MPG a little bit, maybe for those people that are actually towing or doing work with their M-badged crossovers and SUVs.
I don't know that customer exists, but sure.
Not sure, but
person.
In theory, I mean, if you have better low end torque, better ratios, that can translate to just, you know, better overall towing characteristics.
Sure.
In any case, these are the new updates on the
is like the regular X5 and X6, the M models. They also get that BMW curve display, as they call it. Yes. It follows the trend that we've been seeing of you have separate screens, but they're inside one bezel. So it's, you know, it's not actually one big massive screen, but it kind of looks that way when you see it.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Now, do we know when these are coming and what the pricing is? I think we have pricing.
An arrival. I got to look at that.
Pricing, if I remember correctly.
No, I'm looking at pricing. I just.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They. I do not know. Oh, I'm sorry. They go into production in April 2023.
Okay.
So come you would expect the end of spring. Arrival at dealers, you know, maybe early May.
Yeah,
there's generally a lead time between production starting and them actually arriving at dealers. Prices for the X5, $123,295 after destination. For the X6, $128,195.
And I seem to vaguely remember us having a conversation about the X5 and X6. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of weeks ago when the standard models debuted, about the pricing difference between them and just being like, I mean, why would you go for the X6 when you can have the X5 with a little more functionality, with the exact same performance, with, I mean, possibly better or worse looks, I guess, depending on how you feel about it. The difference in pricing at the M level still surprises me.
I mean, it's, you know, there are people at BMW who are smarter than us and have looked at the numbers and said there are a group of buyers out there willing to pay a premium for, you know, that coupe inspired look. More power to them, I guess.
So, Bruce, I mean, have you seen some of the BMW design choices lately? Are they really smarter than us? Probably. I mean, they know their market. They know the people. Yeah, they know the people that are buying these. I mean, they're both pretty pricey. but they're some of the best performing high performance SUVs crossovers you're gonna get. So Bravo BMW.
Because you also have to remember there is the XM now, which is, you know, the full on the top of the heap M SUV. Mm-hmm. So quite a few high performance SUVs in the BMW stable at the moment.
For sure. For sure. Well, but you want to jump to their crosstown rival, Mercedes?
Cross country, but
cross country. Like, well, hey, the Germans, the US automakers, it's crosstown to me, right? Okay. Maybe not really. But you get what I'm saying. Ramblers get what I'm saying.
I get you.
The German competition, Mercedes. We know that the new E-Class is coming. They've started a teaser.
So many spy shots of it. I've written so many Mercedes spy shot stories.
And you know what? I'll be honest. It does get a little repetitive after a while. Mercedes E-Class spied turning a corner. Mercedes E-Class spied from behind. Mercedes E-Class spied in a parking lot. You know, it's the Mercedes. They love to parade their test vehicles around. But now there are no spy photos here.
No, these are actual photos of its interior. This is the first time we're getting to see it. Technically, this Mercedes is calling this a teaser, but they're calling it that because they gave us no specs, but they gave us 20 pictures of it. So, you know, maybe I don't know exactly the size of the screen, but I can tell you it's there.
Right. And I mean, yeah, we don't have any specs. They did provide some information, though, some interesting information. I mean, first of all, if you're familiar with the Mercedes, the EQE, you're going to see some similarity here, especially on the EQE without the hyperscreen, because that's really what we're looking at here. It's got the big digital display that goes across with the optional passenger display on the passenger side, big display in the middle. The driver gets a tablet style display that sits up. So it's not all integrated into one big piece. But there is a lot of similarity to the EQE there. One thing that I really like about this, they get rid of the kind of like the big turbine style vents for the dash. These vents are just
for a while.
They're just integrated right into basically the outer edges of the dash. And the result for me, I mean, it's just a very smooth, clean look that I rather like.
Agreed.
It's not entirely touchscreen. They do have buttons that are now relocated below their center touchscreen, so there are some tactile controls there. But again, Mercedes, they're not going into detail yet on all of those various functions. Not going into detail on screen sizes, but there is kind of a nifty camera that faces the driver. It's not entirely clear if this is also the camera that's basically watching the driver to make sure, when driver assists are on, that you're paying attention straight ahead.
I would bet you would combine those features into one thing, but
I would think so as well. But we do know that this camera can also be used for video conferencing. If you're going to take a Zoom call in the car, you can do it and you can be on camera now. Obviously, you can't do it while you're driving. The system only works when the vehicle is stopped, but that functionality is now there. And of course, it's a Mercedes E-Class. It's packed with tech. Some of the things that we're told here, comes bundled with TikTok, Angry Birds. You know, if you want to do some video streaming while you're out and about, obviously there'll be safety measures in place so where you're not doing that while you're driving. It's got an optional Zynq Entertainment portal for streaming, video streaming for games, all kinds of stuff like that. That passenger screen uses what they call dual light control tech. That way the passenger can be over there just like chilling out, doing your TikToks and whatever it is you need to do in the passenger seat, aside from being the navigator, which is the de facto role of the passenger. You shouldn't have a screen. But anyways, the tech means that the passenger can look at the screen, watch whatever's going on there, and the driver can't see it. So safety feature in action. It has an active ambient lighting system. And if you go to Motor One Podcast on YouTube or you go to motorone.com, you can see what we're talking about. lots of like LED lights in the interior that can change all kinds of different colors. Active ambient lighting means you can set it up with a stereo and the lights will change with the music. Boom, 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 red, boom, blue.
I can't imagine wanting that, but okay.
I mean, I'm only surrounded by LED lights that I can sync with music, but yeah, I don't even use it here in my office. I take that back. I would probably use it in the car. I think it would be fun in certain occasions at certain times.
Sure. But yeah, you know, this is going, you know, Mercedes, you know, they are known for their technology. It's kind of one of their strong points of the brand, and they are loading this thing with stuff, basically, you know.
It will be loaded up. And I mean, there's supposed to be the world premiere for the new E-Class in the spring. It's interesting that they're calling this a teaser campaign, because I mean, usually a teaser campaign, well, I mean, like we saw today that, I mean, we're not really slated to talk about it, but we got our new Dodge Last Call teaser that just came in today of a leprechaun apparently getting shot up at the hospital with an IV of presumably E85 and turning into a monster leprechaun. That's a teaser. That's like a ridiculous, what the hell is going on here, automotive teaser. Mercedes is right. Like, well, we'll tease the E-Class by revealing the interior. So bravo, Mercedes. I like these kind of teasers.
Yeah, I agree. Well, let's move on. Let's keep the move party along. Going here. Let's talk about the Porsche 911 GT3 RS tribute to Carrera RS package.
Yes, that is a name. And in case you forgot, I mean, this is a vehicle that debuted some months ago, and we're getting close to production
initially, right. But we're getting some more details about it now.
Right. So we're getting close to production now. We're getting some more details. I guess maybe the detail we should talk about first is the price.
Well, we actually had that before. We did know the price, but it's still absolutely absurd.
Let's talk about it again, because
sure.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about what amounts to a few changes costing almost $100,000.
Yeah. So put it out there. A standard 911 GT3 RS, no options, which I'm not sure Porsche sells any of those, since Porsche loves adding their options. But if, you know, you decided not to get anything, it would cost you $223,800. Oh, but you decide that you want that tribute to RS package, that takes the price after destination to $314,000.
That's quite a jump. And what are we getting with that? I mean, we're basically, I mean, it's a tribute to the RS, right? So
it is.
We're getting some green accents.
You're getting lots of green accents,
magnesium wheels.
Yep.
Like colored valve stem caps and keys.
I'm sure those are worth tens of thousands each. Yeah.
Each. Right. Green even touches the rear wing with the end plates featuring the American flag and the RS logo in the striking color.
And you also, according to our, according to 43 scale model of the GT3 RS and the original 73 Carrera RS, you get a car cover and you get a watch.
Crickets. I mean, hey, I'm a Porsche fan. The GT3 RS is just wild and fantastic. It's quite a price jump for the tribute package, but I mean, the enthusiasts, the ones that are really, I mean, the ones that are just laser focused, I mean, they're going to get this. They're going to get this.
Exactly.
The ones that have a 73 Carrera RS under a custom car cover with a Porsche watch collection, they've already got this ordered.
Sure. And so this will make its public debut for anyone who attends the 12 hours of Sebring race that runs from March 15th to 18th. That race will be where this special package makes its public debut. So if you're going there, check it out.
Yeah. I don't.
Sorry. It's much. There's not. It's there's a vehicle we've already seen, but it's just the price is kind of what makes it hilarious, because it's.
And I mean, we know a little bit more, and we know a little bit more about the package and all of that, but it's
totally.
It's I'm trying to be very nice because we have a very good relationship with Porsche.
I think it's fine. It's fine.
It's a stretch. It's a stretch for a tribute package, but the people that are laser focused on this, they've already got one ordered. So
exactly.
I'll smile and leave it at that.
That's okay. And maybe
I'm a little jealous because it's like, well, you know, I'd like to have that too. I mean, I can't afford a GT3 RS.
Right.
But I mean, how many
difference between a GT3 RS and the Tribute Edition? Let alone
maybe that's it. I can't even afford the price difference. I can't even afford the Tribute. Just the package. You know, right. Can I just get the Tribute package and you keep the car? Nah, I can't even do that. But it's a 911 GT3 RS. It's going to be flipping amazing.
Yeah. One last debut before we start talking about some other fun stuff. And this one that is something you wrote up, and that is the refresh for the Cadillac XT4.
I wrote this up late last week, and it's so thrilling that I have to pull my own article up to remind myself of what it's all about. I'm being a little harsher. I'm a Cadillac fan. And the XT4 refresh is here. This is a mid-cycle refresh. And it's conveniently timed with recent debuts of the Chevrolet Trailblazer and Buick Encore GX, other vehicles similar in stature and size to the XT4. But I mean, Cadillac is on a different platform. So, I mean,
the Cadillac is much more luxurious than the Buick or the Chevy.
It's going to be more luxurious. But I mean, the timing of all of these, I think, is kind of well thought out.
Yeah, they've done one a week. It was Trailblazer and then Encore and now this. So,
and on the outside,
smart way to do it.
I mean, you'll struggle to see some differences on the outside unless you really know the model fairly well. The big changes come up front, and by big, I mean you have new smaller LED running lights. Headlights are LED relocated a little bit further down in what would normally be the corner vents. Just some small design changes on the rear fascia. The powertrain, all of that is still the same. That carries over. That's a 2-liter turbo four cylinder, 235 horsepower, 9-speed automatic transmission. Has with the Trailblazer and the Buick Encore GX, the larger changes come inside. That's where it gets a very thorough digital makeover. And by that, I'm talking a 33-inch single display screen with 9K resolution. Cadillac says it's inspired by the Cadillac Lyriq. The screen does have a slight curve to it, so it faces in the driver's direction. If you're at all familiar with the outgoing XT4, which I think debuted in 2018 or 2019 thereabouts. Maybe even a little older by modern standards. I mean, that's not old, but just design and technology is progressing so quick. It looks like such an outdated interior with just its big dial gauges, stacks of buttons. This 33-inch digital display, it kind of wipes all that out. It really brings a modern look to the interior of the XT4. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not completely minimalistic. You still have a fair amount of tactile buttons there on the lower part of the dash and the center console. There's still a big shift stalk up there. I think it's very smart on Cadillac's part. They recognize the buyers for this vehicle. They don't necessarily want everything just wiped away clean. But it's all incorporated, I think, in a very handsome design.
I agree.
Technology-wise, you're getting a few more standard issue safety systems. You're getting things like Google built in as part of the software suite. One thing that I'm going to mention, and I'm not going to try to be a jerk about it.
I'm not sure what you're going to say. So tell me.
So here's the deal. The XT4, it's available in luxury. That's the what you would call the base trim. I hate to call it base though, because I mean there's still a lot of great standard issue items in there.
Entry level.
You get luxury, mid grade is premium luxury, and then sport is the higher grade. Now, you do get a lot of standard issue safety systems. But there's an additional active safety pack that will add things like adaptive cruise control, enhanced automatic emergency braking, pedestrian alert, speed assist, some other features, which, okay, if you want to relegate that to a separate package, that's fine. You're still getting a lot of standard issue items, mm-hmm. but that package isn't available on the luxury, on the entry level luxury. You can only get that on the premium luxury or the sport. And I mean, we're talking about some assist and safety systems. Why would you want to relegate that away from your base trim? Right. I mean, we're not talking about 20,000 way heated, ventilated, cooled, massaging seats that are really a proper luxury item. We're talking about things that can help the driver navigate the vehicle and help on a safety measure. And I feel like I've seen this from GM before, where there are some features that are really helpful, but they tend to get buried in higher level trims or certain packages that just feels, it feels like they're maybe doing a little bit of a disservice here. That's kind of my take on it. I was really disappointed to hear that they were relegating that to higher level trim packages. Right. It just seemed a little disappointing to me.
I think that's fair. I've got two dogs barking behind me, so I'm hoping it's not a lot of that picking up.
And I can tell they're a little upset by it too. They're like, come on, Cadillac. You gonna make me get the premium luxury if I want to have adaptive cruise control?
I definitely see what you're saying. I think there's something to be said to that. That's, you know, luxury features when you talk about, you know, interior tech or stuff like that are one thing, but then it always feels like safety tech is the type of thing ideally that automakers should try to put in as many vehicles as possible, because as long as that stuff's working, then you know someone is safer in their vehicle. You know, they're safer when they go down the road.
And I mean to be clear, let me just state here, I mean, like blind spot monitoring, Cadillac offers over a dozen standard issue driver assist. I was stalling here. I was trying to pull up the information that I had on this. There are over a dozen standard issue driver assist safety systems, rear cross traffic alert with braking, lane keep assist, automatic light high beam control, lane departure. So, I mean, it's not like they're skimping out. It's not like they're incorporating some of these, in my opinion, critical features for higher level trims. It just feels like if you're going to offer these systems, make them available on all of your trim levels. And if you want to upsell people on some of the higher trims, don't do it with safety and driver assist systems. Do it with things like, you know, the 50 watt or the 50 speaker, 20,000 watt stereo system, the dancing ambient lights, things like that. That's my little criticism of the day.
Okay. I think that's fair. As we've been talking, I think you and I are both a bit low energy and also perhaps slightly persnickety tonight. So I hope
I am absolutely not low energy. I have all kinds of energy in this beverage that I'm drinking right here.
Okay. Well, maybe.
And there's a winter storm blazing outside, so I've got nothing better to do than to sit here and talk cars. Even if it was gorgeous outside, I would want to sit here and talk cars, because this, hey, we're rambling.
Same here.
This is great stuff. What else we got, Bruce?
Well, we are going to do some reader emails and some reader comments, because we got some really interesting ones. One I didn't even know about until just before we started the show. So
I might let you handle that one. As a reminder to all the ramblers out there, how can you contact us? podcast@motorone.com. You can always comment on our articles that go up every Friday at motorone.com. And you can always go over to Motor One Podcast on YouTube, drop a comment there. And just as a reminder again, what's the date for the live broadcast, Bruce?
March 22nd.
Not only can you comment there, you can comment live and chat with us live, and we can respond live. And we're so looking forward to that, especially when we get we just have the best fans. We have the best followers, the best listeners. And I'm not just saying that. Can I jump into this email here first, Bruce?
Go for it.
Can I take this first one? Because this just came in today from Gino. Gino is a longtime listener. And this goes back to some of our Super Bowl discussions that we were talking about. We were talking, Bruce, if you recall, about some of our favorite big game commercials of all time. And I had called out specifically the classic kid Darth Vader with Volkswagen, where you had the little kid, he's running around dressed as Darth Vader. He's trying to use the Force. He's just completely dejected because everything he does, nothing works. And then dad comes home in the Volkswagen. He goes out to try to do something with the car. Dad hits the remote start button. The car starts. The kid's like, holy crap, I did it. And it's the best performance from somebody whose face or features you just absolutely cannot see. It's just, I think it's gold. It turns out apparently Gino was involved in making that commercial.
Yeah.
So don't we have some of the best listeners rambling about cars? Gino sending this email. Smith, I was stoked that your favorite automotive commercial was VW Star Wars. We called it The Force. It was one of those commercials you knew while making it, it was going to be special. The young actor, Max Page, was spot on for the project, did an amazing job. The director is really good, knows how to get a performance out of his actors. You will see in the call sheet. And yeah, Gino even sent us like call sheets and stuff on this. Just amazing. Mm-hmm. There was a backup child actor just in case, but as it turned out, Max did all of the scenes. Sometimes children, they can get distracted and bored, especially with the helmet on. And Max just knocked it all out. They did it in one location over 2 days. And Bruce, if you can vamp for me just a moment, I've got a few pictures that I'll pull up that I can share from the set. I won't say exclusive because I don't know if, I mean, it's been quite a few years, but hey,
right.
Rambling about cars, go to Motor One Podcast on YouTube. You can get a look at some behind the scenes photos that I'm about to bring up here.
Yeah. First time I've seen these photos, at least. And it's just interesting because, you know, we do this show and we, you know, we appreciate and love having so many listeners, but it's just always interesting hearing your guys or your folks' experience with cars and, you know, things like that. It's really a cool thing to like get an email like this and get like a behind the scenes look at something.
So we're taking a look here right now. I mean, we just got a few photos here, but yeah. I mean, a black and white shot here of the V-dub with the big camera on the boom. What else do we got here? Just a little shot of kid Darth Vader, Max in the kitchen, looking really frustrated, trying to get his sandwich to move by the Force and just wasn't making it happen. And
you can see that is a, you know, that's as they're shooting it, you can see that, you know, that's where they're previewing how everything looks in that shot. So,
Just neat little behind the scenes stuff. Some direction given to Max trying to make this Volkswagen start. I mean, it's just little behind the scenes stuff like this that I love. It makes these things come alive. So Gino, thank you so, so much for sending in that email, brightening our day. Go to Motor One Podcast on YouTube to see what we're just talking about there. And always email
podcast. I've got one to read now.
Yes.
So this comes from Lee, and I do not believe Lee has commented before. So it's always cool to get an email from a new commenter. The title of this email is Peak Crossover ? So have that in your heads. So it starts, Dear Ramblers, checking in to say thanks for the great work you've been putting in together for the last couple of months. I had this experience last week and wanted to run a question by you. I was on the second floor of a large building where I work. I was teaching a class on thermodynamics. And yeah, that probably is about as bad as it sounds. That doesn't sound bad at all. It sounds great.
Thermodynamics. We have some like listeners that are way smarter than us, Bruce.
Yep. and glanced out across the parking lot below. My eyes landed on the rear of a new white crossover that I thought looked like a Honda HRV. I kept looking a little longer. The class was taking a test so I could get away with it, and realized that there were four rings spread across the back, not a Honda HRV, but one of the new smaller Audis. I admit it wasn't my finest moment of vehicle identification, but I know it's hard to make two box design look different from one another. But have we reached a peak crossover when a Honda HRV at first glance could be mistaken for an Audi or something similar? And what comes next if not crossover? Keep rambling, and I hope the live recordings go great.
Well, you know, I mean, that's an interesting, and thanks for the message. Thanks for the email, big time. When I hear somebody talk about a lot of the new cars look alike, I mean, you're not wrong. There are only so many ways you can design a vehicle, especially nowadays with SUVs and crossovers being so prevalent.
Sure.
But when I look back to like the 40s, and especially in the 50s, all I see are like big chrome grills, big chrome bumpers. And I mean, unless you know some specifics, and I'm not saying that they look alike, but unless you really know some specifics, the average person is going to look at that and is that an Oldsmobile or is that a Pontiac or is that, you know, in some cases, even a Ford? I mean, I think Chrysler at that time had relatively distinctive styling from some
you're
of the other brands.
What? 50s, like you're saying now?
Primarily in the 50s, primarily through the 50s. Okay. Well, we'll say like 50 to 59, because I mean, immediately post-war, you still had sort of an era there where manufacturers, because there was a pause during World War II.
There was.
Yep. You had manufacturers, okay, now we got to start, you know, getting things back up. So there's still a lot of like early 40s, late 30s styling cues at the mm-hmm. end of the 40s. And then, you know, through the 50s, you really started to see it change. And I mean, it's big grills, it's big chrome grills, it's big chrome bumpers. And I mean, I see a lot of similarity there. And okay. I think the same can be said for modern day. If you know specifically what to look for, you'll be able to identify these, but I don't know that it's necessarily a sign of the times. I think it's a sign maybe more of the popularity of a segment, because I mean, in the 50s, sure, we're talking about, I mean, sedans everywhere, big sedans on American streets, big sedans with big chrome grills, big chrome bumpers, big wide stance. And you see that now with SUVs.
Yeah. I think something that Lee says is very, very accurate, and that is with a two box shape. And what he means by that, you talk about sometimes like a three box shape or a one box shape, and essentially one box for a two box shape, one box is the hood and where the engine goes, and the other box is the whole passenger compartment. So you can, you know, you can be really, really reductive and just make it two boxes. And he's right, when you that basically is what an SUV or crossover kind of has to look like, or at least it did for a long time. The counter argument to that is actually things like the BMW X6 that we were talking about, which is a vehicle I know you and I mm-hmm. don't necessarily like, but it does kind of try to do something different where it's not as boxy. Problem mm-hmm. with that is you give up, you know, cargo volume and sometimes also headroom because you have that really sloping roofline. But where I was going with this is that I think that this is an issue with designing cars in general, especially in certain segments, though, where it gets really tricky. Like, Smith, I know we have written about, you know, various commercial vans, you know, Ford Transit, Mercedes mm-hmm. Sprinter, etc. Those essentially, the design, because you're trying to pack as much stuff in them as possible, the designers, all they can really do is tweak the front end and like maybe do some stuff to the taillights, because mm-hmm. otherwise the people that they are selling those vehicles to, they kind of sort of don't care what it looks like in a way. They basically are buying it to pack crap into it.
Yeah. Is there space inside? Is it decent on fuel?
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, to a certain extent, you're seeing that in SUVs, is that automakers know, you know, they do all sorts of workshops and stuff with potential buyers, and they're talking to people. They know that their customers want a certain thing. And in order to do that, you have to make the vehicle, to a certain extent, you have to stay within certain boundaries. And then the designers have the hard time of, okay, we have these boundaries, but we have to, you know, be as creative and as interesting as possible in order to lure buyers to our vehicle rather than another one. And so, yeah, I definitely see Lee's point that it can be very, there are lots of vehicles on the road that kind of look alike, but I would also say that, you know, I think Kia honestly really knocks it out of the park, and kind of Kia and Genesis as well, where their crossovers tend to be a little bit more distinctive on the road, at least to my eye. And then you just have like the classics, like, you know, you can tell a Jeep Wrangler from 1,000 paces because it's looked the same forever, and it you know, nothing else looks like it.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And, you know, to your point there, we from time to time on this channel have criticized maybe some automakers for design choices, big grills, things like that.
Sure.
But are we at a point where you need to be polarizing like that if you want to stand out from the crowd? And is this a case of anything different is good? Question to ponder.
Yeah, I mean, we had this discussion in our team's chat a while back, regarding, since EVs, you don't actually need a hood really for an EV. Like, depending on packaging, maybe you're putting some stuff there, but, you know, the size of the hood can be far smaller with an electric vehicle.
Right.
And I remember we got into a debate in chat whether that would mean radically different looking vehicles. And we had people on one side saying, you know, yes, you know, designers are going to explore these things. And then we had other people saying no, because people have in their mind what a car is supposed to look like. And whether automakers are afraid to deviate from that, whether they don't want to deviate from that. But, you know, you can have far different packaging in an EV and let that change the design significantly if, you know, they think there's a market for it.
That was a great discussion. I remember that because I was on the side of, yes, EVs, at least in my opinion, a proper vision for an automaker should be, yes, let's electric powertrains dictate important changes in vehicle design. There's a preconceived notion of how vehicles are supposed to look. Sure.
Right.
But that's only because for 100 years, vehicles have had to incorporate some form of internal combustion with some form of, with some system for cooling, with some system for getting exhaust gases out of the vehicle, for storage of various fluids. We don't need that anymore. We don't need a radiator. We don't need a cooling system. We don't need an exhaust system.
EVs still have cooling systems. It's just the air needed to cool them is significantly less. And so you don't need big grills.
You don't need big grills with vents to try to cool everything down. Exactly.
Right.
You don't need transmission tunnels anymore, exactly, taking up space in the interior. You don't need tunnels going from front to back to make space for a drive shaft. Or an exhaust system. You don't need all of that stuff. So how can we make a vehicle better for a person? Like you were saying with, you know, especially with commercial vans, and even tying that into SUVs. As long as it can do this certain function, that's like the first best avenue to take. Mm-hmm. Let's take a really critical look at how vehicle design can change, how it can benefit the needs of people. And if it radically changes the look, doesn't mean it has to look bad. It will look different.
Right.
But let's take that approach. And if I remember correctly, our discussion kind of focused on BMW, which is staying very traditional with the styling of its electric vehicles. Its electric offerings thus far basically just look like their combustion powered vehicles, just with, you know, different lighting, maybe small change. Mercedes, on the other hand, they are creating slightly different shapes, that the proportions look a little bit different. You can tell it's not a combustion car, but they're doing that because electric powertrains, they offer advantages, and they're trying to take advantage of that. And that's the direction I think it should go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to do one last comment, and then let's get to the barn finds. And this is from frequent listener and commenter, Ted Adam Green. He said, "I didn't watch the Super Bowl, so it was good to get your review of the commercials. I enjoyed the guest, and I hope he keeps coming back off and on. And with the GM electric until they're available in volume. And when will that be? Is it ramping up according to plan, or are there challenges slowing them down? Thanks for another great ramble. Keep it up."
Well, thanks, Ted, as always, for sending in. I mean, yeah, the GM is ramping up.
The GM thing is something you and I have discussed before, is that a lot of those vehicles were announced too early. Not that the vehicle wasn't ready or things like that, but they put the idea of this vehicle in someone's mind and then said, you can't buy it for 2 years. And it kind of feel, you know, I kind of can see what he's saying is, I think GM can build these vehicles. It's just that, you know, they announce their roadmap for EVs so far in advance that you hear about, you know, so the GMC Sierra EV is the one that kind of jumps to mind, because we're not getting it until spring, early 2024. So it just feels like, well, I've seen
it was announced, I've got cool
pictures, but
it was announced months ago. And we're still over a year away from getting it. And I mean, you're spot on there. And we've seen other automakers debut vehicles long before, you know, at the very least several months, if not a year or more, before they go on sale. And we've had that discussion before on here on Rambling, where are they losing potential customers by jumping out here too early, letting things drag on? By that time, the excitement has waned. I was excited about this a year ago when you announced it, but I wanted to buy a new car a year ago. I already have my new car now. You know, there's,
I think poster child for this is the Cybertruck, because
now,
what was it? I think it's 2019.
It's older than that. I think it's 2018. It might even be 2017.
No, it wasn't. It couldn't have been that long.
Okay, 17 anyway, or 2018. But yeah, now, as I understand, there have just been some delays there. COVID delays.
Shortage. But also, they didn't have to show it 5 years ago. I'm not saying it was actually 5 years ago, but you know, they didn't have to show it years ago and then still not have a date for it. And I think that's kind of a version of that is what's happening with a lot of these GM electric vehicles, is that they've been announced and then we're still waiting for them. But it feels like in a certain way they're, you know, because, you know, they come out with specs and pricing and all this stuff and like release cadence. I remember that for when the Hummer EV came out, they're like, we're going to do one this year. And then in the fall that we're going to get the next trim. And then a year from now, the base model is going to come out. And it can feel kind of frustrating in a certain way.
Oh, because, for sure. You know. And I think part of that is related to the nature of, frankly, the automotive times we live in right now. We are in a paradigm shift, and I don't use that term lightly. The automotive industry right now is going through an adjustment unlike anything in its past. And I break it down like this. You have basically the invention of the automobile in the late 1800s. For the most part, engine-wise, driveline-wise, the basic mechanicals didn't really start to change significantly. That's barring, you know, body styles, things like that. Didn't make any real significant change until we started to get into the 70s, where we started to see some computer control, where we had to have more... you know, more thought put into emissions, more thought put into safety. That sort of pushed automakers into more of a technological challenge to try to, to try to meet these goals. And you start to see the advent of computer control. That's a big, that's the start of a big shift right there. And now as we're moving into electrification, automation, it's even a bigger transition right now. I wouldn't call that shift to computers a paradigm shift. I call the switch to electrification and more automation a significant change.
I kind of like that argument, because there's an argument to be made that the internal combustion engine, they essentially kept improving on it for roughly a century.
Right.
You know, it kept it, but it was still, you know, what is it?
There's still a spark. There's still valves. There's still crankshafts. There's still camshafts in there.
Right.
I mean, you go from like points to, you know, a more advanced electronic distributor systems to,
right. Or you go from,
you know, to coil fuel unplug,
fuel injection, right. And things like that. But it was still a gradual improvement. Mm-hmm. And we know EVs did exist, but you know, they were those things like, it would be, you know, 100 just like batteries in a van, or
it's like, you know, the one battery that you start your car with, well, we'll put 100 of them in there and we'll just give you a big starter motor. And that's how you drive your car.
Yeah, it was just never viable until the past 20. I mean, you could make 15 years. You could maybe even argue 20, something like that. Mm-hmm. That, yeah. So I think what you're saying has some merit.
And with that shift, I think a lot of automakers are feeling pressure to either get going on products and get them launched, or at the very least come out and say, hey, this stuff is happening. Look what we have going on. I kind of lump GM into that category. They have a lot of electric vehicles in the pipeline. They've introduced a lot of them. They've debuted a lot of them. It's still going to be a while before they enter production. Whether the early announcements pays off, I mean, we'll just have to wait and see. But I think there's a lot of pressure being felt there to say, hey, look, here's everything that we have going. We're moving much of our production into electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. And here are specifics, not just, you know, we're going to create over the next 5 years, we're going to come out with 5 new SUVs. No. Here's the GMC Hummer. Here is the Chevrolet Silverado EV. Here is the Chevrolet Blazer EV. Here is the Equinox. You know, they got really specific where other automakers are saying in the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to have a new crossover. So I think that's the difference. Instead of being kind of generic, GM just came right out and said exactly what they're going to be. But the time frame is still kind of the same. And it's a little, it can be a little off-putting. I think we've rambled this one pretty good, man.
Yeah, I think so. That was a good conversation. Let's talk about some barn finds. Let's talk about the oldest cars as opposed to the future.
Let's go backwards. And actually, one of the barn finds that we're going to talk about goes back almost to the beginning. Goes back to 1931. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about this because I feel like, I mean, barn finds aren't anything new, but I feel like we're seeing more of them cropping up lately. Some of the most recent, well, the most recent as of our recording here is this 1931 Duesenberg. This video just cropped up. And I'm old enough. I'm not old enough to remember Duesenbergs when they're new. No, I'm not that old, not even close to being that old, but I'm old enough to remember the classic car scene before muscle cars took off. Mm-hmm. And when you saw places like Barrett Jackson before they were on national television, these were the vehicles like the 30s Duesenbergs,
the big
V16 Cadillacs, the big Link. Mm-hmm. Those were the cars that were bringing like six figures and in some cases even seven figures. And Duesenberg, I mean, it's a Duesenberg. It's one of the most prestigious cars from the 1930s, from that era. In its time, it was world class, right?
Right.
And this bar find came up recently.
Yeah. What's interesting about Duesenbergs as well is that it came from the era of coach builders, which for anyone who's unfamiliar with the idea, essentially you would buy a rolling chassis from Duesenberg. You know, you'd have the engine, the transmission. Mm-hmm. I think you had like the firewall. but then you contacted another company to put the body on. And so, you know, the dimensions for all of the Duesenberg Model J's are the same, but they have completely different bodies. So this one specifically in this story, it's one of only 25 of its body by Murphy and with a disappearing convertible top. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just, it makes it even more special.
It's super rare. I mean, our headline on this article, 1931 Duesenberg locked away for 55 years as a $1 million barn find. I'm not an appraiser, but I wouldn't be surprised to see something like this go to auction for that kind of price. And yeah, stored for 55 years. In this case, barn find, it wasn't in a barn. It was stored in at least a partially climate controlled garage, from what I understand. But it was shoved in there for 55 years. It barely fit. They had to remove the bumpers to get it to fit in mm-hmm. this garage. And as we come upon just these barn finds that we keep seeing, when I saw this, I found this just a couple days ago on YouTube, because I search around for this stuff. It's like, who makes a Duesenberg barn find?
Sure.
It's like, okay, hey, check out this old Shelby Mustang that I found. Yeah, you know, there were a fair amount of those. It's like, who puts a Duesenberg into a barn or a garage and just forgets about it for over 50 years? According to our article, it was found by a member of the family that owns the Auburn Cord Duesenberg Company in Oklahoma, received a call from a lady who had the car stored in her garage. He was almost in disbelief. I'm reading the words from our colleague Jacob, who wrote this up here. He was almost in disbelief. It's like, what? You know, and it kind of goes with what I said. How does somebody forget a Duesenberg is just sitting in the garage? I mean, I'm sure it wasn't forgotten. It was just hey, we'll put it here. We'll get around to it eventually. Who knows, Bruce? Maybe my 95 Taurus show sitting in my shop here. If something happens to me and then it's, you know, people move on and 30 years from now, hey, what's this thing under this cover? Who saved a Taurus? What? Why is a Taurus sitting here? But I mean, this, I wanted to talk about this because a Duesenberg sure. barn find. I mean, I know there are people say it's like the holy grail of barn finds. Oh, it's going to be like some rare muscle car.
Hemi Cuda, something like that.
Hemi Cuda. I mean, for me, it's a Duesenberg. I think the only thing that would top this would be like 1936 Auburn Boattail Speedster.
Sure.
You know, uncovered after sitting 60 years in a barn. It's like, okay, that would be a pretty cool find, because I'm a big fan of those cards. But this isn't the only one about here.
So this is one of my personal favorites that I wrote up recently. Mm-hmm. And this one is in France, actually. And this is less of a is a barn find, because there are barns involved, but there are also just fields of cars. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to play the video just in case, but right. We chose to highlight a rare BMW 2000 CS coupe that was in kind of remarkably good condition. If you're watching here on YouTube, you can see it's dirty, but the interior was pretty good. A few trim pieces were falling off, other than the head was off the engine, or was it the valve cover was off the engine, but everything else looked to be there. So this is a car that someone mm-hmm. could take and restore. But the wild thing was just how many cars there were here. So the video was done by someone in England who went to France to look at these cars. So we don't actually know why all of these cars were there. I don't know. I speculate. I don't know if it was a junkyard and, you know, or what, because it's just everything. It's weird, like Citroens, which mm-hmm. you'd expect. Okay, it's in France, but there's also like military vehicles, and there's a transport truck for a fire department. And I'm trying to think, just everything. And
I remember seeing outside. Yeah.
The stuff that's sitting outside is literally like there are trees and plants growing over some of them and you can't even tell they're a car. And then there are also all these like outbuildings and lean-tos and stuff like that. And the stuff in there, obviously, since it's a little more protected, you know, that looks fine. This BMW is in what they called the main building. Also in there was a Mercedes-Benz 450 SE, you know, kind of the sedan from the 70s, and also an SLC. So there were other things in there too. There was also a giant commercial truck that had bicycles piled on it above the cab. So hundreds of bicycles essentially, but yeah, it's quite the sight to see. And I would love to know the story behind it. Cause some of it, you could believe, okay, they were wrecked cars, but some of the cars didn't look wrecked. It looked like they just got parked there. So,
is that the video? Cause I've seen so many of these videos recently. Is that the one where, I mean, you come upon a car where the hood was open and it was just left open? Literally somebody was working on it. I was like, oh, you know what? I got to go to the bathroom. And that was like 25 years ago. It's just like, there's like boxes and there's tools laying there. Was that this one or is that another video?
No, that's not this one then. No,
It must be another one.
But yeah,
like I said, we've done so many. Well, let me talk about one here. I'll go a little bit further in the past. This one actually got big traffic and I was surprised and a little disappointed. Just in some of the comments, especially on this guy's YouTube page, because the person that posted this video enjoys cars and is a car enthusiast, but isn't a car expert. And that's absolutely fine. They were out there. He was with a company doing some work on this person's property. And the person said, hey, while you're here, you know, walk around some of my barns and you know, check out some of the cars that are here. And he didn't know exactly what he was looking at. If you can vamp for me just a second, Bruce, bring up my screen here. He didn't know exactly what he was looking at.
I'm not entirely sure which one you're talking about. I probably will remember it once I see the headline and the video and stuff. But
I do remember this one. Yeah. Mustang Boss 429, which, okay, that's like a holy grail muscle car barn find. Challenger RT convertible, another holy grail muscle car barn find. I say that 10 times fast. That's a tongue twister. Discovered an epic barn find. There was a Torino Cobra Jet, a Pontiac GTO. This is kind of what you were talking about, Bruce, where, I mean, there are cars just everywhere. I can't play the video just because just be on the safe side. But it starts outside and there are all kinds of just cars and parts outside. If I remember correctly, there were some older Mustang parts cars outside. There were some Pontiac parts cars outside. I think there were some motorcycles, nothing super extraordinary. I think there was an early 70s Roadrunner outside. And it's just like, okay. I mean, it's pretty cool. It's pretty neat. And then he walks into this barn and, you know, the first thing I think the first thing he sees, he notices the Challenger. He's a fan of Challengers and he's walking by the stuff. And as soon as he got close, I was like, holy something that I shouldn't say here on YouTube. That's a Boss 429. He's standing next to that's a 1969 Boss 429 Mustang. I can't remember, something like 1200 or 1300, I think, total built. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't know it. But I mean, I'm kind of a Ford guy. He saw the Challenger RT. And then as he got close to the Challenger RT, and then I realized, oh, I think that's a 70 Challenger RT convertible. That's super rare. In fact, I think I mentioned it here in the article. Let's see here. 859 Boss 429s built in 1969. The Challenger RT convertible, 963. 1970.
Wow, I didn't realize they were that rare. I knew it was rare.
I mean, right there, those two cars could like put, I mean, that's like a really nice, nice, nice house sitting there. Yes. In those two cars covered in dirt. And I couldn't see the engine bay clear enough on the Challenger to see if it was a Hemi car. God forbid if it was a Hemi car, but it's sitting right next to a Boss 429. Who knows? It could have been a Hemi car.
Yeah,
we never get a clear shot under the hood. And then there's a, I mean, there's like a 65 or 66 Mustang Fastback sitting over there. You know, finally the guy walks back. He starts walking around the Mustang. He's like, wow, look at these scoops. And he's like, there's a car show sign behind the Mustang that's talking about the Mustang. So he was able to learn a little bit about it. And I thought the Torino Cobra Jet was super cool. An original GT. I mean, just tons of money, probably over $1 million easily sitting there in that barn.
Oh,
hoods up, covered in dirt. And it's just like, wow. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was fascinating. The owner, I mean, the owner apparently knows what he has there. But I was a little
wash it.
I mean, I was a little disappointed because I'm reading through the guy's YouTube, and I mean, super cool YouTuber. And this is another case where people, you can love cars, you can be an enthusiast, you can be enthusiastic, and not be an expert. You don't have to be an expert to go out and look at these cars and enjoy them and then share the experience. And this guy was just kind of getting lit up. Oh, what you think is a Pontiac is really an Oldsmobile. And then you should really learn cars before you start posting cars. Dude, shut up, man. I'm going to be for snickery. Shut up. The guy posted a very cool video. And I personally got quite a few emails from people saying, hey, where's this place at? And apparently the YouTuber was getting some messages too, because I think he posted on the YouTube video. It's like, you know, hey, this is just a guy's place in California. You know, he's told me he doesn't want to sell any of the cars. So, but I mean, that stands out as just kind of one of the more shocking ones that I've seen recently.
Yeah. So I'll do one last one here. And this is a car, I'll be honest, I don't really like. I think you'll agree with me. It's a car from a time. It's just, they don't get much love. And I kind of think that's deserved because it was weird. But the story behind it, I think, is what's interesting. So this is a story we ran recently about a 2005 Chevrolet SSR barn find.
That's a weird one, man.
The car has 950 miles on it. So,
and you see it and you're like, it's like a 2005 barn find?
Yeah, it's a 2005.
But yeah, go ahead.
But 950 miles, which basically means someone took delivery, drove it a couple weekends, and then parked it, because that's about all you'd be able to cover in that distance. And
it wasn't parked in a garage. It was parked in a stanky ass barn, right? Because it looks like it's been sitting in this barn. It looks like a barn find. It's covered in dirt. It's covered in grime, and it's like 950 miles, man.
So yeah, and it sold for $50,000 on eBay, $49,875. So clearly someone wanted it, but just bizarre. I would just love the story of, you buy a new car, a performance car, whatever, a vaguely performance car. You drive it for 950 miles, and then clearly just park it and leave it.
It's certainly a weird one. I mean, it's not like a case of
this example. This is one of the ones that people actually. So the early SSRs, they had a 5.3 liter Vortec V8. But for 2005, they finally gave them the LS2.
Yep.
And this one has the optional manual gearbox, which people want. So
it's desirable.
Right, yeah, it's got the right powertrain combination. I just don't know what happened. And so the mystery is what intrigues me.
Well, and I think if I remember correctly, there were some other vehicles in that barn that were going to be
up for sale
shortly. I mean, that might be a case. Okay. 950 miles. Safe to say it's probably been sitting since 2005 or maybe 2006.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's been sitting a while. There might be some issue with seals, but unless there's damage on the outside, I mean, it's been inside, so you shouldn't really have any sun damage. Give it a good wash, give it a good clean, And that's probably still going to look like a pretty darn good new vehicle.
Yeah.
And it's definitely one of the weird ones.
I know we're finishing up. What's your take on the SSR? Am I wrong that they're, I don't like them.
I was never a fan personally. I don't hate them like the Pontiac Grand Am, but well, it's like they didn't really make sense as a truck.
No.
And it was really too heavy to be a really enthusiastic performer. Although that V8, the later V8, which I think was right around 400 and some horsepower with the manual transmission. I mean, that's a desirable combo.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be a fun cruiser for like Woodward Dream Cruise, mm-hmm. or just a cruiser like that.
Yeah.
And if it was priced in such a manner to be more of a novelty kind of cruiser like that, it's sort of the same thing that happened, I think, with the Ford Thunderbird.
I was just thinking that
generation that came out kind of around the same time, trying to capture the really strong retro vibe that was happening at the moment without really, I think, considering beyond just the retro vibe. Let's also mm-hmm. make it a vehicle that's really good at something. Right. And the reality at least in my opinion, it's designed like a retro looking truck. So I guess the really good thing it does is it tries to capture retro vibes, because it doesn't function as a good truck, because if I remember correctly, the bed was carpeted and all that, and you're not going to haul anything back.
Correct. Yeah.
So it's doesn't work as a really good truck. You want to buy it as a cool performance vehicle. Okay, cool. But it's still heavy, and it's still not going to be a very thrilling vehicle, especially I think for a little bit more of the time you could go buy a Corvette. I mean, these were pricey.
Right. And the other, you know, you had the Pontiac GTO at that time, you mm-hmm. had the Corvette, and you had the SSR. I'm pretty sure they all had the same LS2, maybe with slightly different tunes or whatever.
With the manual option. And
with the manual, those three.
The Corvette and the GTO. And I love that era GTO. I mean, that was brought over from Australia. That was a Holden Monaro.
Yeah.
It got panned for its bland styling. And it's like, in my mind, it was the only true retro minded muscle car of that time, because the original GTO was a bland styled car with a big ass engine. And that's exactly kind of what this was. And people were panning it. Oh, it doesn't look special. Mm-hmm. It's a GTO, right? But yeah, either one of those two, the GTO or the Corvette, those are your performance heroes over the SSR.
Agreed.
And you're paying, if I remember correctly, you're paying about the same price for all three of them. So yeah, I think.
Yeah.
But the SSR, obviously, I mean, it has a strong following, and that one sold pretty well.
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to be our show for tonight. As always, good afternoon, good evening, or good night. We appreciate all of our listeners and all of our comments and things like that. Sorry if I was a bit low energy today.
You are not low energy.
Tired tonight for some reason.
Let me give you a little background. Everybody's sick right now.
I'm not sick.
It's like half of the world is sick.
Yeah. But yeah, please look forward to seeing us March 22nd, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, and then do the calculations for wherever you live. We're working on getting some guests. We'll definitely have guests. We're just still working on who those guests will be. And yeah, we're looking forward to it and can't wait to talk to you all live.
In the meantime, talk to us at podcast@motorone.com. Send us the emails. Give us feedback on barn finds, on BMWs, on Cadillacs, Mercedes, everything we talked about, or something we didn't talk about. Make it completely different. Just as long as it's car related. We love to hear from you. We love to read it on the air, share about it, talk about it, all the good stuff.
I would love to hear if anyone out there has a barn find story. A Vespa that my dad has was technically a barn find. It lived in a barn for who knows how long. We bought two of them. One of them was just a frame, and then the other one had everything, but was a little bit beat up, and we've restored it, and very cool.
Send us the barn finds. Give us that taste.
Yeah. But that'll do it, folks. Bye-bye.
See you. Bye-bye.